Thank you, Maggie. Welcome, Kim, and nice to be with you, John. You know, we live in a time that people are nervous. They're nervous about jobs. They're nervous about the economy and the world. And if you just looked at a distance, you would see the major movements are the onslaught of technology, our love of scale, our love of cost, privatization. We're way into that. And what's invisible is that there's a counter movement occurring that could give people hope that that we're not just going to get stuck in this spot. And this counter movement is occurring in every discipline. In architecture, people are talking about cooperative neighborhoods, pocket neighborhoods, pocket design to bring back the commons. And so this collaborative movement occurs in economics. There's time banking. And so whenever you in art, in housing, co-housing, there's cooperative education, there's cooperative businesses are having a movement. So whenever I find a new discipline where the value of collaboration, cooperation, connection, relatedness occurs, it's very exciting. And I think part of our job is to weave together all these elements and realize there is a cooperative, collective, communal movement occurring in this country and probably in the world. And so when I discovered Kim, I got really excited because law is patterns our thinking. It's so important. And Kim now is giving her life to a whole kind of inversion of our thinking about what law can contribute to us as society. So that's why I think, Kim, what you're doing is so important. And we welcome you here.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, maybe you could start by just for all of us giving us a little headline about integrative law, what it means to you, how you got into it, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, I have a shorthand that isn't 100% accurate, but I use it to describe the movement sort of as my elevator speech, and that's lawyers as peacemakers, problem solvers, and healers of conflicts.
Wow.
And there are a lot of other roles that lawyers can take inside the integrative law movement, but I think that kind of points you in the right direction.
So say those again slowly. I want to let them sink in.
Lawyers as peacemakers, problem solvers, and healers of conflicts.
And what's unique about that? What's this thinking?
Lawyers are trained to polarize people, actually. We're trained to focus on the differences and really refine those differences. And that training is good for some things, but it's really not good for living in community. It's not a relational approach. It's not really workable. I mean, it's a nice intellectual exercise. But lawyers who are actually working with people need to learn how to listen to them, how to find out what their interests are, to help them communicate with each other, help them figure out how do you reconcile these seeming diverse interests, these things that seem like they're complete opposites. How do we do that? And how do we heal the conflicts that arise that keep us from going forward? And getting things done and, you know, being in relationship to each other. The world's way too small for us to be polarized from each other.
Now, when you write and speak and train people, in addition to the kind of intention, what are your trainings like? What do you need to add to what lawyers already know?
Well, lawyers have to be a little bit untrained. and in law school, we're trained to focus on the intellect. We're trained to focus on the differences. And we're trained to think that anything having to do with emotions, feelings, values, those sorts of things are not relevant. And they're actually the most human relevant pieces. There's very rarely a conflict that isn't based on really deep emotion. Now, I remember many years ago when I was just getting started as a lawyer, I said, well, I can see where this kind of approach would be really good in family law, where there are kids and their husbands and their wives and there are a lot of emotions, but it probably isn't as applicable in corporate law. And the corporate lawyer who was much more experienced than I looked at me and said, corporations are made up of people, and that very often those people are having very emotional investments in their conflict. And so I've had the blessing of 25 years of looking through that lens and realizing that it's all about emotion and it's all about our relatedness. And we need to be retrained as lawyers to be looking at that.
Are you practicing law now, Kim?
I have a very small practice of working with people on contracts. For 20-something years, I was a family lawyer.
Can you give us a quick example, especially in the non-family arena, of how this process might work?
Well, it's less a process and more of a lens.
Okay.
So, for example, in a non-family area, a case that I was talking to somebody about the other day, it's a case of two businesses. One, they were partners, and one of the people left to start a new business. And that's sort of a very typical non-compete kind of case from a legal perspective. It's not real complex. But if I take that out of that analytical kind of sterile environment and tell you that what happened was two women started a beauty salon. They were best friends. And they built this beauty salon, and all of their friends came, and it's a small town, and they developed a community, and then they had a falling out, and one of them left and moved across the street and opened her own beauty salon, and the people in town started splitting between the two businesses.
Wow.
You can start to see how that would be really an emotional issue.
Yeah.
As it's a business issue, and the legal piece of it is a business issue. But the real issues are much bigger than that.
Yeah. So, what
and so integrative lawyers take all of that into account. We don't just go into the silo of the legal issues. We look at it in a more holistic way.
So what might an integrative lawyer do in this situation?
Well, I think that there could be several approaches. That particular case is in litigation, unfortunately, and the lawyer who asked me about it was doing her own work. She's a yoga teacher, and she was using her yoga knowledge to look at how the conflict was going and looking to see if there was a way that she could move things to sort of encourage peace rather than the polarization. So even the way she litigates is a more integrative approach. But if early on, before a lawsuit were filed even, if they had sat down with each other and had a conversation, it might have avoided the split. And so a lot of times people go to lawyers when they're upset, and the first thing the lawyer says is, oh, you have this legal case and you can sue. And that's like pouring gas on the fire. So an integrative lawyer is going to be looking at where can we resolve this most quickly, which also often translates into less expensive, and preserving the relationships, not preserving the, quote, legal rights.
Kim, this is John. I'm just wondering,
yeah.
you gave the case of the beauty salon,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed to me the way you were taking the contract case and translating it into two women was personalizing a situation. And
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, it seems to me that professionalism generally is a way of approaching something by depersonalizing it.
Yes.
And
yes.
That your various examples tend to say, well, no, what we want to start with is the person and understand the relationships and the emotions, which is sort of anti-professional in the, as you say, most lawyers are taught to be intellectual and to set a table for a conflict. What I wonder about is lawyers that pursue the directions you're suggesting, if they've been trained in law school to do the opposite of what you're talking about, how do you deal with that? Are there law schools that that really are preparing people to be peacemakers and problem solvers? Supposing a young person is listening in and they say, well, gee, I want to move in this direction. Where would they go?
Well, the good news is that there are a lot of law schools that are starting to do that now.
Great. Tell us a little more about that.
The dean of the law school in Arkansas actually just published something today that I got in my social media about happiness. There's a book about lawyers and happiness. I think it's called The Happy Lawyer, that was written by some law professors at Missouri. So I'm using those specific examples to show you that it's not just California or, you know, some of the places that you think of as being, change leaders. Arkansas and Missouri are not, the heartland. And so those people are leading the way. There is a group, there are several groups. There's a group called Balance in Legal Education that's looking at a lot of these sorts of issues from a more holistic perspective that is a part of the Academy of American Law Schools. And it has hundreds of members.
Wow.
So there is some effort, and there's a lot of pushback about, we've always trained lawyers to think like lawyers. The paper chase was a really great example of what it's like. If you are in a contracts class and you start talking about people's values or what they feel about something, law students will literally laugh. I actually speak at law schools all around the world. I've been on four continents doing this kind of work with law students, and it's universal. I can go in and I can set up a scenario, and they're listening to my hypothetical, and I say, now what do you think she felt about that? And there's nervous laughter, because that's not what they're being trained to do, and it's not what they're used to. And it's not that thinking like a lawyer is a bad thing. It's just not the only thing. And law school has historically failed to educate the whole person. So it's a movement, and there's a lot of positive growth, and then there's a lot of pushback as well.
How do you see the pushback? What form does it take? How do you hear about that?
It comes in the academy looks down on the professors who are doing the cutting edge work in this.
Yeah.
And the funding. A lot of the classes that the law students think are most valuable are those that are taught by adjuncts and are not fully funded.
Interesting.
A lot of different ways.
They're kind of lonely people, even though, you know, they probably find each other in some ways.
Yeah. Well, a lot of my work has been finding people and letting them know they're not alone. It's probably what I've done more of in the last 20 years than anything else.
Yeah. And that makes me wonder, it seems to me that people who are drawn to medicine usually are people who want to cure people or fight disease, right? But there is developing holistic medicine. And I'm not sure that the doctors that want to cure people are the same as the doctors who see the environment at a holistic setting as the world that they're dealing with. I'm wondering whether or not, in a sense, you would like to see lawyers who have both kinds of skills, but isn't it possible that there are people of a certain kind of orientation and background who are good at doing what you're interested in, and that it's a matter in part of the nature of the person and their orientation rather than educating them. I don't know whether you understand what I'm saying.
I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think that it's a both-and situation. There actually have been some studies that law students who are entering are normal people. And by the second semester of their second year, something has shifted. And they're much more motivated by extrinsic values.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the work that's being done, Professor Larry Krieger at Florida State University is doing amazing research in this area of looking at what happens. And it does have to do with the shift in values that law school causes. It also causes depression. The design of law school leads to like a really high, you know, like very statistically significantly high levels of depression among law students and lawyers.
Wow.
And I think my explanation is that we've removed that human part, the part that gives us meaning, the part that connects us to other people, by focusing only on the analytical part. Like, we're told that empathy is no longer a value to pay attention to in law school. So then we lose it for, you know, we lose that part of ourselves, or we devalue that part of ourselves. And that's what makes us human.
Yeah.
You know, John, you want to say something?
Well, I'm, you know, you on our website, you have an article.
Yes.
And in the article, you talk about aspects of this movement, and you give some labels, but I thought they were so fascinating that it might be interesting to hear you expand on them. You say there's something called therapeutic jurisprudence. Can you tell
yes.
us about that?
Therapeutic jurisprudence was invented by two law professors at the same time, basically. They were both doing work, and then they got together and they looked at it and they said, this is a new discipline. And they were looking at the therapeutic or anti-therapeutic impact of the legal system. So
yeah.
if you have a drug case and you go to jail for some drug-related charge, that's an anti-therapeutic result. How would you create a therapeutic result? And so in working with the judges in Miami, Florida, one of the law professors was based there and the other was based between Arizona and Puerto Rico. And they started working with the judges in creating a therapeutic approach. And that's how the drug courts and then eventually the whole problem-solving court movement evolved. And that is actually looking at when you come to court for a case that is a drug case or some other problem that is the real foundation of what's going on. You might have written a bad check, but you had a drug problem. That's why you did it. They actually treat the drug problem. And they put you into a structured program to get off of drugs. And because you're there, you know, you've come to their attention because of the drug problem. They have that, there's a tension of you could go to jail or you could do what you need to do to get clean. And the people who opt into that have said they're going to get clean. And they provide a structure for getting clean. They actually congratulate people. They celebrate their wins. And then they have consequences for when they use drugs. And after a while, they no longer have a drug problem. They've had a support structure that's allowed them to get a job, a place to live, get their kids back, and create a new life.
Wonderful. Another
and so that's
phrase
why therapeutic jurisprudence led to the problem-solving court movement.
Ah, well, take us there a little. You've talked about lawyers. Tell us a little about judges. Are there judges who are sitting on the bench who think of themselves as being part of a problem-solving rather than an adjudication? roll?
Yeah, it's like 2,500 of them, 2,500 courts. It started in Miami, and then it spread around the world. I think I may not get the numbers right, but something like 20 different countries now have problem-solving courts. And I've talked to some people in high places in Florida who said that they'd actually been able to close 7 prisons. And two newspaper articles had reports of a prison in Colorado and a prison in Minnesota closing for lack of prisoners.
Wow.
You mentioned also something as you call sacred activism. That sounds fascinating. What is that about?
Sacred activism. I think I got that term from Andrew Harvey.
Uh-huh.
Which he talks about the thing that breaks your heart. That's the thing that you care the most about. When you look into the world and you see what breaks your heart. And that's where you should be working. And for me, it started with children and family. I'm one of those mothers that I actually believe that it takes a village. And I ended up with 16 children living with me during the years I was raising children.
Wow.
And I have a very complex family constellation of birth children, stepchildren, foster children, children from the streets that came to live with me, just friends, this amazing family constellation. And it was all around making the world a better place for children. And that's how I got involved in this, is because I saw that the legal system was not aligned with that. That parents going through divorce were harming their children. Children who got in trouble were not being restored. They were being thrown away. And so I started learning about all of these different things and wanting to change the legal system out of my commitment to children.
Wonderful.
You know, Kim, you mentioned while we're getting ready to go on what you were thinking about this morning with respect to Mandela and the response to his death and his greatness. I'd like to hear more about what that means to you. You said it's part of it is people don't want to do the work. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot on social media about Mandela and wanting to have leaders like Mandela and wanting to be like Mandela. And Mandela is a great example. You would not have known the title integrative lawyer, but he was a great example of that. He was a peacemaker. He brought together people who thought they had nothing in common and created a country that was aligned. Even the choosing of rugby as a way to align them was a very conscious decision.
Yeah.
That was something that people could all get behind. But what I noticed too is that a lot of the approaches that we do in integrative law are actually harder work. If you go to court and the judge says you go to jail, you can just be a victim about it, and you don't have to take responsibility, and you don't have to apologize to anybody. You don't have to actually work. You're just an actor in a system that sort of at the effect of everything. If you have to actually get your life together, you have to work at it. There's a lot more effort involved. And the same thing with divorces. If you're going through the divorce and you can just fall into the other person as an evil witch, or I want his body parts on a platter or whatever, and fall into that old mold. It's just, it's easy. Everybody knows how to do that. But if you have to say, I need to find a way to co-parent with that person who is now a member of my family forever, and we seem to hate each other right now, and how do we get from where we are to where we want to be? That requires some skin in the game. That requires some authenticity, some inner work, and the helping professionals involved have a lot more work to do than just following the script of going to, you know, the next court hearing or something like that. And so I think one of the reasons that integrative law isn't like the main way of doing things is that we're harder work, but it's that kind of work that really makes a difference in the long run. It's, you know, the example of we're closing prisons because people are getting off drugs and they're not going back to jail, and they are raising their own children instead of having their children in foster care. And, you know, like the domino effect of doing that kind of work makes for a much better society, but it's work.
And in that sense, the kind of lawyer that you're talking about is the barrier between community and prison. That is, now everything, it seems to be, is organized so that the solution to something that's difficult is a prison. But
right.
You're saying, no, that's the least of the solutions, but the solutions that are the alternative are work.
Right. Right. You can lock up everybody who's different from you.
Yeah.
And everybody who offends you, but pretty soon you're standing there alone. That doesn't work. I mean, we have an embarrassing number of people in prison in the U.S. And there are a lot of other alternatives. And we have an embarrassing number of people who are engaged in out-and-out war with somebody that they share children with.
Yeah. One other thing I've just wondered about over the years, if I come to your home and break into it and steal something from it, and the police get involved, the criminal justice system gets involved, this goes into a court and it's labeled is, I suppose, the state of Illinois versus John McKnight.
Yes.
And you are excluded from the process.
Yes.
Although the real problem is activity of relationship between the two of us. So doesn't the court system itself in the criminal law take the personal out of it just by its very definition?
Yes. Yeah, that's part of that professionalism that we were talking about earlier. Like let's take the human factors out of it. And yeah. The kind of case you're describing, another integrative law model that would be really a useful one for that would be a restorative justice model.
Yeah.
So that if you stole my TV, you and I would actually sit down together and I would tell you how it impacted me to have you come into my home and invade the, you know, the sanctity of that safe space and to take something that I had worked hard for. And, you know, I would get to say all that. And you would actually, as the person who did it, get to sit there and listen to the consequences of your actions. And people who go through that process are much less likely to ever steal somebody else's TV because it becomes personal.
Yes. Yeah.
Relational.
Yeah.
You know, let me, we've been going about half an hour. Maybe, Maggie, you could invite people to phone in, give them the process for that, and maybe, you know, see if there's some comments or questions people would like to ask that are on the phone.
Absolutely. So if you would like to have if you have a question for Kim, Peter, or John, you can simply press *8 on your phone. And I'll see that you're calling in, and I can unmute you so that you can be part of this conversation. There are a few comments in the chat. Peter, are you able to see the chat today?
Yes, I am.
Okay. There are no questions there, but there have been some activity.
Well, let me just, I don't know, you know, somebody said that in today's Globe and Mail in Toronto, the judges are pushing back against unjust penalties brought in against the poor and the mentally ill, and some very interesting Commons feels that we may finally be reaching a plate tectonic positive tipping point on many fronts, although it's under the radar. There's another interesting comment that's a couple. One was a counselor and one was a lawyer. And years ago, they were told they could not practice together. And in fact, as I understand it, the lawyer turned to the ministry. So those are some of the comments coming in.
And one interesting one, too, that just came in is the mayor's office in Seattle just hired a director of restorative justice. San Francisco has restorative practices throughout its school system.
Ah, in the school system. That sounds fascinating. And what city is it again?
That was San Francisco.
Francisco, in the school system.
Yeah. The New York Times just did a series on restorative practices in schools. I think that they focused on a school in Boston, and they showed some pretty amazing results. A friend of mine, Sylvia Clute, is doing that kind of work in the schools in Richmond, Virginia. And some of her stories are just extraordinary. The student, she actually does what she calls unitive justice, which is there is no victim, there is no offender, because you don't know what actually is the whole picture. They just do a circle process and explore together what happened. And she told one story that I thought was really telling about a student who kept getting in trouble moved to the front of the room, and he was really acting out when he was at the front of the room, and the teacher called a circle, thinking that she's the victim of all of this, and he's got to behave and all of that. And what turned out in the circle was that he was afraid when he didn't have his back to the wall because of the environment he'd grown up in.
Mm.
And when that came out, she realized she was being the perpetrator.
Oh, yes.
That's amazing.
You know,
so let me invite.
Go ahead.
If you're on the call, we sure would love your comments. We'd love to hear any thoughts you have about this conversation is triggering in you. It doesn't have to be a question.
We do have one, Peter, that I'd like to invite into the call.
Okay, great.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Edgar Kahn wanting to call in.
Hey,
hi, Edgar.
Hi, I've been enjoying this because you're really doing two things. You're doing problem solving, which I think is basic, but you're really doing system change, which is really combining a vision with a sense of what's wrong with the system. And we're seeing a drop in applications to law school because I think law students, folks who want to change the world, don't know how they're going to make a living doing that. And I think we really have to look at the whole system because something's very wrong. Just as with health, we're looking at disease but not at health. I think you're looking at justice, not just at problem solving. And I just want to say that you're a real hero of mine, and I'm thrilled that that Peter and John are giving you a chance to be heard by a wider audience.
Yeah, Edgar and Kim both. I was in the latter 50s the director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Illinois. And the grand old scion of that chapter was a guy named Charlie Liebman, and he had retired, and he came into my office about once a week and sat and talked with me. And I remember that he said to me, since I was a young man, our role has changed so much. He said, when I was a young man, we were never called lawyers or attorneys. We were called counselor. And he said, now nobody calls me counselor. They say I'm a lawyer, right? And that makes me wonder, and Edgar, you may have some special perspective on this. if you went back historically, might it be that the kind of roles that Kim is talking about were a living part of what the lawyers did? We call them counselors, and that we've sort of lost something? Is there a historical base for this idea?
I think there is an historical base for it, but it's the same trend we've seen between primary care doctors and specialists. I think money has driven us into specialties, and it's all about bottom line, and we're forgetting that there was another bottom line that brought us into the profession in the first place.
I want to say, if anybody is on the call that doesn't know who Edgar Kahn is, I'm really honored to have him here and that he said what he said. I just can't even be with that. But he's a great example. He's actually teaching social change in law school. and it has a whole career of social change behind him. So I also, Abraham Lincoln said lawyers should be peacemakers. So it goes at least that far back. Or that's the, I don't, the exact quote is something like that's the lawyer's greatest role. And one of the things I did when I first started practicing law, I actually changed my business card to counselor at law.
Ah.
As a way of distinguishing myself.
I love the title. And I think we have to look, frankly, at the economics. And we have to really pioneer a whole new model, one where clients can co-pay with paying it forward with community service, and second, where we have to look at a new kind of legal insurance, just as we look at health insurance differently, because the world is not getting less complicated, and the knowledge that law schools impart is very important, but we don't have an economic system in the practice of law that begins to look at what would it mean to give one's life to the kind of lawyering that you're doing.
That's great. Thank you, Edgar. Let me just ask, Maggie, is there anybody else having a question?
Not on the, not calling in, Peter. There was a question in the chat.
Yeah.
Thank you, Edgar, for listening and joining us. It's
Peter, I have a question. I have somebody here with me who has a question. April Doner, here she is.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for this awesome conversation. So it's actually a quick story, not as much a maybe with a question at the end. So I'm living in Indianapolis now, and one of the reasons I moved there is the really incredible community building work going on at a grassroots level from within and around Broadway United Methodist Church. And I worked over the summer with an effort that they've been doing for about 5 years now called the Roving Youth Corps, where they pay youth who live in the neighborhood to go around and act as connectors and roving listeners. And they were originally trained by Diamond Hargis, who some of you may have heard of. So anyway, I worked over the summer as one of the kind of team leaders for this project, and a laptop that I'd recently had bought for me for business was stolen by one of the young people who'd been coming around for this work. And it was an incredible learning experience for me. We immediately kind of were thinking like, okay, well, how do we react to this in a way that is not the traditional route, because all of us, I think, have the sense that that's not really the way to go. So we actually had a series of very intense conversations and meetings with myself, people within the church staff who were all really devoted to, you know, practicing something different in terms of community and especially how we see marginalized people, and neighbors from the neighborhood, and, you know, really thought about what should we do. And zooming back and looking at, like, where is the source of this thing? And for me as a victim of this, it was really, you know, because I had a lot of feelings coming up. There was anger, there was feelings of being violated, but I also really wanted to look at the bigger picture. So we decided to not press charges at all, and to think about, you know, why did this happen? It's because this kid who we are pretty sure did it, and his family, if we know them, you know, we know that they've actually been really pushed to the edge of society, you know, for whatever deficiencies were first identified in them, you know, through the human service system. And how can we act in a way that will bring them back into community? So we started thinking about, you know, and then how can we build economy? So let's think about what we know of them, of their gifts, of their interest, who knows them in the neighborhood, who could reach out and bring them back into community and show that we care about them. We know the kid is interested in technology, so we were like, okay, well, let's invest in one of these neighbors we know in the neighborhood who could, you know, go connect with this kid and bring him over to this this sound recording studio that we know someone is setting up in the neighborhood. And so, you know, it was a really incredible lesson for me in kind of restorative justice.
How did it work out? Did you get reconnected to the kid and the family?
It's still actually, we're still kind of working on it.
Working on it? Oh,
yeah.
Not easy. That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you, April.
Sure.
I think that's a great example. It's not as fast. It's not, you actually still own the problem. You haven't delegated it to some stranger to just manage it for you.
Yeah.
So, thank you. You know, we're kind of nearing the point, unless there's other questions or comments, of kind of wrapping up. Kim, any other things you'd like to comment on or reflect on, you know, at this moment?
I think that one of the things is that who owns the problem is really an element of this, because the problem of the stolen laptop belongs to her. It doesn't belong to somebody who works in an office downtown, and it belongs to the community that's been impacted by this, and it belongs to the family. That the young person, you know, the person who might have done it, and it involves whoever really did it, who may not be that person. It's the problem doesn't belong in some sterilized professional setting.
It's really a community. That's a beautiful thought.
Yeah.
You know, as you're speaking, couple of people in the chat have mentioned, you know, what we're dealing with are the effects of poverty in many, many, many situations, especially public schools, especially, you know, the people's economic status is a better, much better predictor of how they're going to do in school than anything a teacher or principal can do. And I think you're saying the same thing, that it's a communal question, and the idea of ownership is wonderful. John, any final thoughts you have?
No, I think it's been a wonderful exposition of what's happening in a lot of professions, and Edgar was pointing that out, that we're seeing an evolution away from professional traditions to finding a new way that focuses more on basic causes, focuses on the role of cooperation, and I love the word peacemaking. And certainly Mandela's celebration right now is the right time for us to remember that ultimately reconciliation has worked, and revolution is going on in other places seems not to.
That's great. So I just want to thank you, Kim, so much. You know, I really think it's not an argument against professionalization. It's just recasting what professionals can do to make a difference in the world. So, you know, I just wanted to add that. And I just thank you, Kim. And thank you. Any final things you want to say, Kim?
No, I think I'm complete.
Okay. Anyway, thank you all. Let me give it back to you, Maggie. And
I do want to say thank you very much. But I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Glad you could be with us. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Kim, and Peter and John. This is a lively chat conversation, which I'll make sure to copy and send to all of you, since you need to see that. And we'll end the call for today. Our next call will be on February 11th, and we're about to have a discussion to put together the schedule and the guests for next year. So keep a lookout on the Abundant Community website, and where we will have post a link to the recording of this call so you can hear it again and pass it around. So thank you again for participating, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.